The power of the executive and the bureaucracy would be strengthened at the expense of the people and a duly elected legislature. In other words, imperialism was not only going to have a devastating effect on the indigenous peoples of Africa and elsewhere, it was also going to have an erosive effect on European democratic institutions and practices. There was no way around this, Hobson argued. Hobson's was, I think, at the time, the most fully developed critique of European imperialism. And received a great deal of attention. This economic argument seems quite plausible. Certainly, if one thinks about the dynamo of European industrialization in the late 19th century, the sense of European optimism, the sense of limitless possibilities of investment and so on, then there's a certain plausibility to it. But as historians and others have looked at the timing question, some problems with the economic arguments put forward by both Hobson and Lennon come to the fore. For one thing, colonial markets were, from beginning to end, very poor. Only one-fifth of all French capital invested overseas was invested in colonies. Only 12% of its foreign trade went to colonies. In Germany, only 1% of its exports were directed toward colonies. And in Great Britain, one-third of its foreign trade went to colonies, but those were mostly in the more settled areas of the British Empire. That is, not in the newly acquired territories in Africa. Moreover, they were the least profitable to investors. Russian, French, British, German investors tended to invest elsewhere, not in these newly acquired colonies. French investors, for example, after 1890, invested far more of their, quote, excess capital, close quote, in Russia than in French colonies in Africa or in Asia. The same was true of Great Britain. Great Britain invested heavily abroad, but its greatest investments, by far its greatest investments, came in the United States, especially with the British investments in American railroads. So these two factors have thrown some doubt on the power of the economic explanation. Also, the expansion, colonial expansion of the 1880s and the 1890s does not correspond to the period of the greatest excess capital in Europe, which came well before the 1880s. So the timing issue here seems to be off. The need for sources to invest abroad had come earlier, not in the 1880s when, as we saw in our previous lecture, this new wave of European imperialism occurred. What about raw materials? Well, the Europeans certainly were aware of the need for raw materials, and this awareness would only grow as the 1880s turned into the 1890s. But the public discussion, and certainly the strategic discussion of the need for raw materials, really burst to the surface in European political life and in domestic discussion in the 1890s. In the 1890s, one can certainly talk about a need to ensure access to raw materials, but not in the 1880s when the great bulk of this new European imperialism had begun. In the 1890s, there was a growing concern that raw materials would be sealed off to a European political power by one of its competitors. And it was in the 1890s that the arms race, the naval race, and so on heated up, and that international tensions were heightened. And as a consequence, in the 90s, one does see very clearly a discussion, and a very, very public one, about the importance of raw materials and the need to acquire access, to maintain access to those materials. But not in the 80s, when this new wave of imperialism began. Indeed, when the discussion of the need for raw materials really reaches its height, there is virtually no more European initiatives in the imperial area.